This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, it's Greg Hoffman from Take Command. And the best part about podcasts is they create a 25th hour in the day. Whenever I'm commuting, metro, car, even when I'm riding my bike around town, although in that case, one earphone only, safety kids, I'm always listening to podcasts. And this offseason, you can get all the insights, all the news, all the analysis, and Logan and I occasionally make a joke or two in the Take Command podcast on demand so it fits in to your busy schedule. Follow Take Command in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your pods.
This is Matt Spiegel, and I can't wait to bring you season two of the PBP, Voices of Baseball. The very best play-by-play voices in the game talk about their craft. It's a job so special that even Joe Buck told us he will probably go back to it.
I'm 53, basically 54. I think it's too early to say nevers at this point in my life. I think at some point I'll get the itch again.
Incredible guests sharing great stories from your favorite teams coming this year. Find us on the Odyssey app or wherever you find podcasts. Podcasts.
It's time to take command with former NFL tight end Logan Paulson and former Commanders beat reporter Craig Hoffman.
What's up? What's happening? Welcome in Take Command podcast. That's Logan Paulson. I am Craig Hoffman. And Logan, we are inside 1 month to the NFL draft. Can you believe it?
I can believe it because it's already starting to be silly season. As you know, when it gets in that 1 month, things get a little bit crazy in terms of rumor mill. It started a little bit earlier than expected, but here we are, you know, so that's always fun.
Yeah, I think I was reminded yesterday of just how silly this season can get. JP Finley was on the radio show with me on Monday, and he's like, remember when the Niners traded up and ultimately took Trey Lance, and everyone knew they were going to take Trey Lance because he was obviously the next guy. But we spent a month being like, did they really just trade up for Mac Jones? And so it's smokescreen season, it's silly season, it's speculation season, which I think leads us directly into our first topic. We'll get in a little bit more into our mock draft 4.0 and kind of breaking down some of the reaction to that later on in the show. But the biggest like bombshell, or at least it seems like it is, but we're going to explain why it's not, this week is J.J. McCarthy all of a sudden being linked to the Commanders at 2. This is largely happening because Tom Pelissero was on his show on NFL Network, The Insiders, and said, I have talked to a lot of people who know Adam Peters very well, and I asked them what he thinks Peters will do, and they go, well, I know Adam, and I think he would take J.J. McCarthy. And I actually think on its surface, that makes a lot of sense. If you look at some of the things that Brock Purdy was really successful at and why he has succeeded in the league, I think J.J. McCarthy has a lot of those similar characteristics. And so if you phrase it as like looking at Adam Peters' history of what works, that seems like a pretty logical assumption. But what was not said is I have talked to people who know what Adam Peters is thinking for the Commanders in 2024, and they think he's going to take J.J. McCarthy. No. This is speculation based off of what these people who know Adam Peters think of Adam Peters. They might have ulterior motives. Thus, it is silly season, Logan. So to me, that's why this all of us, like being able to be like, oh, okay, I understand what Tom is saying. Is really important, which I like to play media translator sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I also think there is merit to how seriously should we be looking at J.J. McCarthy as a potential number two overall pick when you break it down on film. So both of those things, wherever direction you want to go.
Yeah. So first off, I'm kind of surprised that like Tom, like even like kind of like he can report that, I guess. But like it is the way he worded it. It's a little like he knows what he's doing. He's stirring the pot a little bit, which is fine. You know, it is the season. So kudos to him.
But tis the season. He's got a television show.
Yeah, I think that's, and he's got to do it every week probably or every couple of days. So I think like that's important for fans to understand, like fans are freaking out. You know, our producer just read us an email of a fan who was like, you can't do this. This is impossible. It's going to light the franchise on fire. And I think like people are weighing those comments a little bit too seriously because it's like he could have talked to me or like, you know, so it could have been anybody. Like I know Adam and this is what he would do. And it's like, but you don't know what Adam's doing. And I think one of the things Adam's always been extremely clear about is his vision as a GM is to make it the coach's team, right? Is to be a conduit for finding talent for the coaches and the coach's vision, you know? And so what Adam's going to do in this situation is going to be different than what Adam did when he was in San Francisco. So I think that's just important context to understand. And I think it's also important to talk about the player, JJ McCarthy. And I think I've said this before in the show, do a lot of shows. So if I'm repeating myself, I'm sorry. But like one of the things, like when you watch Jaden Daniels, like when you watch his film, his game tape is the best, right? When you watch Drake May, his throws over the middle of the field are the best, right? His big time throw percentage is the best. When you watch JJ McCarthy, his red zone, his third long, his 2 minute stuff is excellent. And there are coaches and teams and evaluators that look at that and they say, this is what quarterbacking in the NFL in 2024 is going to look like. It looks like this. So in terms of projecting skill set, it becomes very easy to watch. Like I find myself doing it all the time. I don't know if I sent you that tape I was watching last night, but you watch his, like I watched his Iowa game last night and you're like, this is an NFL throw. This is an NFL throw. This is an NFL throw. And then you compare that to someone like Jaden Daniels or even Drake May or Bo Nix or Michael Penix, where 75% of the offense is a screen or a bubble or a quick game. It kind of lets you rest your head easy on the pillow at night saying, I know JJ sees it, can process it, and can throw with the physical talent to get this done. So is two a little bit high given some of the risk factors associated with his low throw volume? I think absolutely. But at the same time, like, you know, I had a scout tell me this once, and I think it's great insight. Cutups will lie to you, right? And so, but when you watch those cutups, he is by far the best guy in those categories. And so if that's what you like as a team, if that's what you like as an Italian evaluator, if that's what you like as a coach, that's what's important to you, I 100% understand you taking him that high. Now, I don't value those same things the exact same way, but there's something comforting about watching him throw for throw for throw and being like, that's an NFL progression. That's an NFL window. That's an NFL read. That's an NFL protection. Like that, there's something kind of comforting about that.
For sure. So I think a couple of things. One, in terms of taking him at two, if you really think he's the guy, you absolutely do not mess around. Like if you are that, we'd be kind of like, we'll settle for him and like be fine because we traded back or whatever. If you're like, JJ McCarthy is that bleepity bleeping dude, you take him at two and you do not risk it. Right. And at that point, Peters and Quinn and everybody better be right. Cause if you Mitchell Trubisky it, or, you know, one of these other guys that's gone that high and it hasn't worked out and you were kind of off the board from everyone else and it doesn't work out, that's your job. So you get one shot at that. And if you're a first time GM and Adam Peters, like, do you want to take that risk? I don't know. We'll see. So that is one thing that I think is worth considering. Another thing that I think is interesting, Greg McElroy made this point on Mina Kimes' show. She actually does a really cool thing on her show that we should do at some point. I'm definitely going to do it on the radio show, where she brings on an analyst and she gives that analyst two players. And it's like, she calls it the war room. And so it's like, I'll give you two players. You take one, or like at number one, I'll give you Caleb Williams or Drake May. You take Caleb Williams for Chicago. All right, now we're at two, Washington. Drake May, Jaden Daniels. Take Drake May or Jaden Daniels and move on. And like two options, keep it moving throughout the draft. But as he was talking about JJ McCarthy, McElroy, of course, the former Alabama quarterback and SEC Network analyst, said, I don't think people realize how hard it is to play quarterback in the kind of offense that they ran at Michigan. Because they didn't ask him to do a lot. Now it's the opposite type of hard that Caleb Williams, for instance, had to deal with. Williams had a terrible defense, a terrible offensive line, and had to score 50 points a game, it felt like at times, by himself. But for McCarthy, it's like, hey, we're only going to come to you in high leverage situations. And you're not going to have any rhythm because we don't throw it that much. You're going to hand off. That didn't work. We're now in third and 12. And we need you to make a big time throw. And so it's a lot easier at that point to be like, well, damn, he does it most of the time. And some of these throws that are off, it's like, well, yeah, he hasn't thrown it in a quarter and a half. He hasn't made a throw in game in an hour of real time. And I think it's a really good point by McElroy, where in the NFL, you're obviously hoping to not do that, where you probably can't do that because you got to pass the ball with a little bit more frequency.
No, I think that's 100% right. And so again, like when you're watching the Iowa game, you're watching the national championship game, like watching the Alabama game, like like how leveraged he is in third down, these 2 minute situations, like it's tough, man. These are not like easy opportunities. There's no like easy mode. Like his easy mode is when he's handing it off, but when he's throwing the ball, Like, it's tough now. It is tough. And you see him have hard times. I forget what game it was. I was watching a game a couple of days ago. And, you know, he's struggling bad because he's not really seeing it very well. The defense has him. But I'd say for the majority of the season, you see a guy who's competitive. He's athletic. He's got tremendous arm talent. Like, watching him throw in person, you don't realize, like, you know, like everyone's talking about his pro day and how impressive it was. I honestly think it's because a lot of the media members who go to that event have not seen him throw in person before. And so when you see that ball jump out of his hand, you're like, this guy is different. Like, and so you were talking about being off the board, you know, and I'm not even sure they would be off the board with this selection as it kind of relates to other NFL teams. I think a lot of teams see how talented this kid is and his upside. I think it's just about, you know, like, do you think you have the environment that can develop him? And I think when you look at him, he's a better athlete than Drake May. He's got a better arm than Jaden Daniels. Like, he's been in an offense that is, again, very, very challenging from a leverage difficulty standpoint. There's a lot of stuff to like. There's a lot of stuff to like. And I think, so to me, like, this conversation of him going at two, like, I could definitely see, you know, Adam Peters or Dan Quinn saying, and imagine what this guy's like in the room. Like, that's the other thing I was thinking about. That's something we're not privy to. Like, when I went to his press conference when I was at the combine, and just the way he stood at the podium, the way he spoke to the crowd, he's charismatic, he's relatable. And Jaden Daniels is standing right next to him, and Jaden Daniels is quiet and kind of, you know, that's his personality. There's nothing wrong with that. But I do think there's something about that traditional quarterback personality, that traditional quarterback bravado, that's going to entice some teams. So there's a lot of factors here that we're not privy to. But I think in terms of the stuff you see on tape, there is definitely an argument and definitely a perspective. And I'm not saying they should do this. Let's just be very clear. But if they did do this, I'd be like, sick. Like, they must see something. They must like the kid. They must, because when you look at the talent, man, he is uber, uber talented. And I think that's something that I find very intoxicating as well, with him specifically.
So what are the biggest thing that people bring up as a negative is throw volume. But yeah. Like, okay, that is what it is. It's not actually, like, that makes the evaluation hard, but it's not actually a negative. I guess you less experience, you've seen less stuff by a little bit. But what are the negatives on him? Why do you think he's behind these other guys in terms of prospects? Everything you just said makes him sound like he'd be a gem.
Yeah, and I think that's why people are excited about him. I think that's why people in the NFL are excited about him. And I think that's why if you picked him at 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, you'd be like, this is, like, I would be doing backflips because I'm like, this dude has the potential, the ceiling to be one of these other guys. I think the thing is, like, when you talk to quarterbacks about him and about this process and about the throw volume, it's just he can do it. I've seen him do it. Like, when I was at the combine watching him throw, he has the ability to layer throws, but he just doesn't know always when you watch the film of when to do it. And in the NFL, you're going to have to learn on the job. And I don't think that's not always the most conducive environment to do that. Like, you'll see him, like, again, in the Iowa game, he's throwing a deep dig. So first off, he fits it in this incredibly tight window. So great job. The next play, the configuration of the defense is slightly different. He doesn't need to laser it. He needs to kind of put it over somebody and drop it in the bucket. And it sails a little bit on him and he misses the throw. And I'm like, he can do that, but he just doesn't have the reps. And so the inconsistency with the footwork that you see with Drake May that leads to the incompletions isn't there with JJ McCarthy. It's just he doesn't have the throw volume that Drake May does. And I think that's the thing that is a little bit worrisome about him as a prospect is, you know, like, I don't want you learning and figuring this out when you have to carry a team. And I think that's why, to me, I kind of bucket him and Drake May into the same category, kind of. Obviously, like, they're different players, but there's a similarity in that I think they would be excellent pros if they could sit for a year and just kind of get more throws, practice, be in the offense, develop some better habits with regards to certain things. But I think that's the thing that gets me really nervous is, like, it's good. The good is very good, but there's also, like, this learning curve that he hasn't accommodated yet, which makes me a little bit nervous.
Gotcha. So the last thing I want to hit on real quick on quarterback, because I've been thinking about this a lot, because I kind of flippantly say, like, if these guys are all on the same tier, then trading back is whatever, because at that point you don't care which of the three that you really get. Like, you have some preference, but it's not so strong that it's not worth whatever else you would add on the later picks that you accumulate. But I feel like these three are so different stylistically that I find that hard to believe that that's going to be the case, which is why I keep coming back to, I think the most likely outcome is they take one of these guys at two. So like, is that accurate that the styles are so different that even if they're on the same tier, if you're a GM, you probably have a pretty strong preference of one of the three?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think there's going to be a stylistic preference and a personality preference. I think you're going to fall in love with one of them. You know, you're going to like through the combine, through the pro days, through the personal visits, not the event themselves, but the dinner pre and post that you have with your staff and this player, right? Like I heard something on Daniel Jeremiah's podcast where the scouting department took the whole offense from, I forget, it was USC out so they could see how Carson Palmer interacted with the team and, you know, kind of how the guys gravitated towards him. And I think that's where someone's going to say, like, this is the differentiating factor. Because again, like we've talked about the pros and cons of all three of these guys. And, you know, Jaden Daniels is a guy that I think is a dynamic electric playmaker. Fundamentals are tight, releases quick, great deep ball. Don't see the throws over the middle of the field. It's there, but not with the volume you want to see. And then we've talked about Drake May, talked about JJ McCarthy. I really think it's the intangible stuff. And I think that's something as an evaluator of the draft process that I cannot overstate how important that is. Like I have talked to guys about prospects before and they're like, he's just a weird guy. I don't like him as a person. And then that's the differentiating factor. And I think like that's something that I keep coming back to is if they're all in the same tier, right? If they're all in the same tier, you're going to like one of them more than the others. You're going to want to work with one more than the others. And I think that's the crux of this, right? Like let's say you love JJ McCarthy and you're kind of lukewarm on Drake May, just hypothetically. It could be the reverse. Let's say you love Drake May and you're lukewarm on JJ. You're going to pick the guy that you love. Like there's no doubt about it. And you should pick him at two. Because I don't think there's a big enough discrepancy, especially with how teams are kind of hungering for this quarterback in this year's draft. Seemingly, there's all these quarterback needy teams kind of right in the same area. You might not be able to get back up and get them. And I think that's the big concern here with trading back than trying to trade back up is you're going to miss the guy that you want because you were trying to get too cute. So,
yeah, I think that's ultimately probably where they land. You know, we'll see if New England doesn't want to do quarterback this year and Minnesota's desperate, can you figure that out and like get back to three if you don't like the same guy that Minnesota wants? But yeah, that's the thing is like this becomes a big, on some level, game of chicken, but it's also, I think, this hidden part of the draft of like who are the scouts and especially GMs that have good information. Because if you've got two teams that want Drake May, let's say that, and you're not one of them, you love JJ and you're like, JJ's our guy, like, we're going to figure out how to get JJ, but I got two teams that are desperate for Drake May then, or like, you know, New England loves Drake May. Can you entice Minnesota to come up to two and then be like, sorry, New England, Drake May is gone. You want to trade back with us and you pick up something extra to go, you know, back to 11 up to three. Like you do this, but like you said, you might also be getting too cute there. Just take your guy and let New England and Minnesota play their game and, you know, do their trade while you get to sit back and be like, we got the guy we want. Our hands are clean. So it becomes this, again, how solid is your information? What's your risk tolerance? And we don't know any of this about Adam Peters. We know he's willing to move. We've seen that with John Lynch and Kyle out in San Francisco with the Trey Lance deal and some others. But just how much risk tolerance do they have? We'll find out. Do you have any inclination, like if you had to guess today, based off of, because like, I guess this would be the other part too, is like how much of this is about what Adam likes, how much of this is about what Dan likes, how much of this is about what Cliff likes and what Cliff wants for the offense. Is there any of those three that you would lean towards, or it's just impossible to know because of the personality piece and that's going to be the big separator?
I think the personality piece is going to be the big separator. And, you know, initially, like I kind of thought Jaden Daniels was going to be the guy because I do think the kind of spread them out offense, the air raid offense. And I know he's not running the air raid offense specifically anymore, but there's principles there, right? It just functions better when the quarterback can move around a little bit. Like the problem when you're in the gun a lot is it limits the runs you can get to. It limits the direction you can run, limits the types of runs you can have. And I think when you add the quarterback, it adds this diversity, the quarterback running element, it adds this diversity to the backfield. Now I say that, but you know, when you watch JJ, for example, like they run quarterback power with him at Michigan. They run zone read with him, and he's very effective. He's outrunning DBs, he's outrunning safeties. So maybe you say we like the arm talent, and even though he's not quite a good runner, we say JJ. So, but initially, I think Jaden. I think Jaden's quick release. I think the way he sees stuff. I've talked to a couple people over the course of the last couple of weeks who say he's an excellent worker. He prepares like at a very, very high level. So I'd probably lean that way ever so slightly, but I do think this JJ thing is plausible. I know fans maybe don't want to hear that, but I would just say go watch a highlight of him, go watch a cut up of him, go watch a game, and he's going to miss throws, no doubt about it. But like his big time stuff is big time, and when he runs, he's fast, and he's bigger than the other guy. You know, he's 6'1". I think he weighed in at 218 at the combine, 220 at the combine.
Yeah, so, I remember I watched an interview with him, and Matt, like our pal Matt Miller, is not a big dude, but yeah. Like we've seen NFL players on camera before. Yeah. JJ's not as small as I think people think he is.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing is you go back to, and again, I think Drake May, like when you look at the things that they did in 2021, Cliff did in 2021 in terms of throwing those deep digs, those drifts over the middle of the field, like Drake does a great job of that. And so I think they all have their thing that, and the thing that I'm encouraged by with this whole process is I do think Cliff has the wherewithal, the staff has the wherewithal to build a program around that player, you know, to kind of say, this is what this guy did well. Let's maximize this. Let's limit what they do poorly. And so that's why I think that ultimately, like, I don't want to say it doesn't matter between these three guys, because I think there's an element of the talent you're bringing in. But I think that the staff is going to be able to speak to the skill set at a high level. But again, kind of to your original question, I'd probably lean ever so slightly to JJ, but I just wanted to point out that those other guys have a lot of merit in some of the offensive principles Cliff has used before.
And just to clarify, you said JJ there. You meant Jaden. You lean slightly towards Jaden Daniels.
Who did I say?
Yeah. You said JJ.
Yeah, I meant Jaden. Yeah.
But you meant JD.
Yes.
Not JJ.
Correct.
We got DM, just a whole initials, potpourri here. For whatever it's worth, this morning at the NFC coaches breakfast, Dan Quinn did say, if any all these reports out there, if anybody knows who they're taking, please let him know, because in his conversations with Adam, they don't know yet. So it is all just speculation, but I would say for what we're trying to do, it's not really speculating. It's just trying to make a guess based off the information that we have and where we think they're trying to go.
And also I think it's important just to kind of say like we're informing the process, right? I think we're trying to peel back the curtain a little bit and inform the process. And I think if they were to take JJ too, I know a lot of fans are like, no, burn the building down, whatever. But I do think there
please
are
don't burn the building down. We do yeah. not inc- we did, no arson on this podcast.
We don't encourage that. But there are. But I would kind of be like, okay, now let's see what they do with that, right? Drake May, same thing. Jaden Daniels, same thing. And so yeah. I think that's how close these guys are, and it really comes back to that personal preference. So I think the reason I wanted to talk about it is because the reaction was so negative. But and again, that's probably a little higher than he should go. But when it comes to quarterback, get the guy you want. You know, get the guy you want. So
you think he's that good, take him. Don't overthink it.
Hey, everyone. This is Brett Boone. Would you know it? I've got a podcast going strong in our fourth year. Tune in as I sit down with my friends, some of the biggest names in sports, media, entertainment, for a lot of fun and in-depth conversations. As you know, baseball's been my life. It's been in the family for a long time, but it's a lot more than that here. It's sort of like taking a ride in a golf cart around a beautiful track. Join me every week for multiple episodes on the Brett Boone Podcast, available on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Take Command. I'm Greg Hoffman. He is Logan Paulson. We did Mock Draft 4.0. I can't believe we've done four of these suckers already. Yeah. Mock Draft 4.0 last week, post first wave of free agency edition, Logan. And the reaction was interesting for sure, because we did something that a lot of people were like, no. And then they're like, yeah, because we both traded back and took Jaden Daniels. But there's also a reaction to what we did with those extra picks and going Latu over an offensive tackle later in the first round. Some of the other decisions that we made. I know you were reading through the comments. I've obviously been reading through them as well. And I think it's probably a good time to take a step back here as we're going to enter an even heavier mock draft season with a month to go until the draft itself. And like, explain the point of what it is to do a mock draft, why we do them, why they're fun, why they're useful. So what's your answer to that question? Like, what's the point of a mock draft?
So I think it's every time we do a mock draft, I learn something new about draft flow, because you have like a very specific perception of the way you think it's going to go. You're like, oh, it's going to go these people, then these people. And then you realize like, oh my gosh, like Minnesota could do that, or New Orleans could do that. And that's going to push this guy down, and this guy's going to be there. And then I have a really high grade on this guy because I thought he was going to go in the top 10. And all of a sudden he's here at 32 or 23 or whatever it is. And so for me, it's just a way to show the variability of the draft, the mock draft, to play out different scenarios. And also, I think, to, again, to kind of peel back the veil of how these conversations go with teams. Like, everyone thinks it's this concrete board. And I think it's because the media kind of cycles the same, you know, 50 guys through your newsfeed every day. But there are differing perspectives on these players. And I think, like, in the context of that one decision we were talking about, which is Leiatu Latu or Olufoshanu, part of that is like, I think we both like Olufoshanu. You know, I think he's a really good player. You think he is. I like Leiatu Latu. I think he's a good player too. But ultimately, like, what that decision came down to in the context of that one specific event was just basically saying, like, what if they did take the person that they had graded higher as opposed to filling a need? What happens then? I know fans were upset by that, but I think that's a very real conversation that happens where they say, man, even though this is a need, this is a good player, we need to fill a need on this team. Like, this is a player we have graded as a top five player, top 10 player, and he's here at 23. We have to take him, you know? And I think that's ultimately what happens there. And I think the other thing I think people forget is they think of the draft as the end all be all when it comes to filling out the roster. There's going to be post-draft cuts. Good football players are going to be available, and you can fill the team out that way. So even though we think, oh, we got to get a tackle, like, in some ways, I don't want a young left tackle. Like, at some point I do. I've always been an advocate for tackle. I think they're hard to find. I think this year is great for getting a tackle. But let's say hypothetically we don't get one. There are other opportunities to fill that need. And I think that's important for fans to kind of keep in, to remember and understand, is that this is a fluid process. And I think the mock draft is just an easy way to kind of show you the variability of the day and why certain decisions, while they might seem crazy, are well-reasoned and justified in the team's eyes.
Yeah, totally. It's never just player A versus player B. It's like, yeah, what are the other things informing? So like, one of the things we looked at in that pick was, what kind of player would we get at the other position if we waited another 20 picks or 10 picks even? I think we were at 23 because we took the Vikings picks and then we were 36 still. And so it's like, okay, if we take Latu at 23, what kind of offensive tackle is available for us at 36? And we really liked the crop that was still available. I think like Guyton was still on the board.
Yeah.
Obviously the guys like Sua Mataia and Patrick Paul were still on the board.
Amarius Mims was still on the board. Like, yeah, there were some really good football players.
There was a ton of guys, and it was like, okay, well, if one of these top guy, Guyton and Mims or whatever, falls, like, hallelujah. But even if it doesn't, like, we can get a really good edge and a guy that's just below those guys at tackle, versus if we switch it, we didn't feel very good about the edges that were going to be available at 36, potentially, in terms of their fit. Now, it turned out that we could have gotten Chop Robinson, and maybe we should have done that. You don't know. Yeah. You know, maybe you should have gone to Amarius Mims at 23 and then Chop Robinson at 36 instead of Latu and whoever, I think, Sua Mataia, whoever we picked. I think we wound up actually going McConkie and then getting Patrick Paul at 40 or whatever it was. So I think that's kind of the thing, is it's, what do you have next time? And also, if you're doing like the real big team building picture, what's next year's class look like?
Right.
Because if you're going, okay, I can get like the sixth best left tackle, or I can sign someone in phase two or three of free agency to get me through the year, and I can prioritize tackle of the future in next year's draft.
Or next year's free agency.
Like, yeah, because like, we know going in, it's a really strong class. Maybe you do that. And I think there's some teams that have done that with, especially quarterback, where it's like, we're going to, you know, kind of pass up this year, try to accumulate picks next year because we want to be up in a particular class, a la the Chicago Bears, perhaps last year, knowing they might have a shot at Caleb Williams, and it kind of worked out for them. So I think that those bigger pictures of the free agency classes, current and future, what your timeline is, current and future, what, you know, other draft capital you have, what this current draft is contouring like, all those things go into that. And I think I agree with you that the mock drafts really show some how certain things can adjust, and all of a sudden, you know, one player falling can shape the entire or change the shape of the entire draft.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, like, even with the Ladd McConkey pick, like, we probably in a real world scenario take Kingsley Suamataia, but we've picked him in three consecutive mock drafts. So let's pick someone different. And I like Ladd a lot, so why not pick him? You know what I'm saying? So there is an element of that, like just getting new names in circulation, because I think that's part of it, right? Like, they might on the day be like, Ladd McConkey is our fourth graded wide receiver. We have him above, and here he is. Let's take him at 36.
Yeah, he's
and
a tier three player, and everyone else on our board's tier four.
And I think that's a great pick. You know, it's the same thing that happened with Leatu Latu and Olufoshanu, right? It's like we just had a slightly higher grade on Leatu Latu, so let's take him. And again, neither one of those is wrong, but those are the types of things that parse out here, because it is so subjective. And I know there's a lot of people that I've spoken with that say, oh, it absolutely has to be player X. But to me, that just tells me you haven't watched enough film to know that there's player X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D. There's a ton of players that could fill this need. And I think that's part of the process, right? Just showing here's some different names, here's some different scenarios that I think work for this team and would make this a better football team.
Yeah. And it's not like we're doing it to be shock jockey. It's just like, let's see what happens here. It's an exercise. Yeah. We're doing things that we think are good for the Commanders, but it's not like a hardcore prediction, because like, what does that even look like? I think that especially when we're relying on a mock draft simulator, right? Like if we're relying on what PFF gives us, I think at some point soon we will do a first round mock where I would say more predictive. Now at that point, like, you know, it was more fun in some ways last year when we were sitting at 16, because we could really shape the first 15 picks before. Like, Chicago is going to take Caleb Williams, and then Washington's going to pick at two, and then we're going to pick whichever quarterback we think at the time is the most likely. But it'll be fun to then see what the rest of the draft looks like and what positions and position groups and specific players will be available for Washington at the top of the second round. So maybe we'll do a 1-40 mock draft where we actually go through and pick every single player. So I think those are more predictive, and like we would say, okay, submit this to the people who grade the mock drafts for accuracy. But I think it's fun to like understand what happens. Cause I'll give you another example in this draft that probably doesn't wind up affecting the Commander. Some weird stuff would have to happen for this player to come into play for them. But like, everyone agrees Brock Bowers is a game changer. He's a tight end out of Georgia, super unique type of athlete, agreed on, I think, pretty universally as one of the 10 best players in this draft. He's starting to fall in some mocks just because a lot of people doing the mocks are valuing other positions. Mm-hmm. And so it winds up being like, do I want the tackle or Brock Bowers? Brock's the better player, but I'm going to go the tackle. And like five teams do that, and suddenly Brock Bowers is available in the middle of the first round. And some team might be like, this is crazy. I'm trading up. Now the whole contour of the draft changes. Right. And so I think those are the kinds of things that when you do these mocks, like happen with some frequency, is you just eventually see one guy who's should not, like, does it make sense with the other names available? And then what do you do if you're the team that's on the board?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And so again, that's part of the process, part of the fun, get some different names in circulation, get some different scenarios. And again, like on the day when we did that, I had Leatu Latu graded higher than Olufoshanu. I did. And so I'm going to pick him there. And then if I'm the GM, I'm going to handle the tackle need in the fourth wave of free agency, the first wave post the draft. Like that's my process there. Cause there are other ways to do that. And I know like Ladd McConkey over Kingsley Suamataia, like Kingsley Suamataia is a developmental prospect. And maybe I feel much better about Ladd's impact year one as a guy that fits with Kingsbury's vision. And I think that's another huge variable here. So again, like good, we drafted good football players. Like I came out of that thinking like, wow, if this happened, like I'd be pretty stoked, you know, but I think it's a different way to build a team, and it doesn't tick all the needs that I think people perceive the team having. And they forget, I think, that there's other opportunities to kind of flesh it out. So
for sure. I do. My favorite comments are the ones that are mad at the simulator. Like we didn't do it. Like, don't yell at us for taking the good football players that the simulator gave us.
Yeah.
But I realize you can't yell at a simulator. So we'll accept your comments with smiles on our faces. Wrapping up here on Take Command with some NFL league-wide news. And the news is, we got some new rules to talk about. Logan, The hip drop tackle, the swivel hip drop tackle, more specifically, has been banned. We'll talk about that in a moment. But as we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, just a few hours ago, the NFL also approved a massive overhaul to the kickoff rules. Here, I'm just going to, Logan, I apologize to you and the audience, but I'm just going to read from the ESPN.com story here to try to give people the full scope of things. So for the people that complain that I talk too much, I'm sorry that I'm about to read a bunch. During the 2024 season, kickers will continue to kick from the 35-yard line, but the other 10 players on the kickoff team will line up at the receiving team's 40-yard line. At least 9 members of the return team will line up in a setup zone between the 35 and 30. So you'll have like a 5-yard zone where return team will match line up, and that's 5 to 10 yards away from the kickoff team. Up to two returners can line up in a landing zone between the goal line and the 20. No one other than the kicker and the returners can move until the ball hits the ground or hits a player inside the landing zone. Touchbacks will be marked at the 30-yard line, and no fair catches will be allowed. In the event a team wants to attempt an onside kick, it will have to inform officials of its intent and would then be allowed to use the NFL's traditional formation. No surprise onside kicks allowed. This, of course, takes the philosophy of the XFL with a slight shift where players are aligned. The more than 90% of kickoffs were returned during the XFL's 2 seasons. NFL special teams coaches who participated in designing the NFL version are hoping for a return rate of at least 80% in 2024. So the goal here, Logan, more returns with less gigantic collisions and thus less concussions and injuries. What do you make of this as a former special teamer who screamed down on kickoffs and buried your head in people?
Yeah, I mean, people don't realize, maybe you do. Kickoff's scary, dude. Like, I used to be back like when the 4-man wedge was there, and that was a very, very physical play. And I think, obviously, I think the steps the NFL has taken to ensure player safety and limit player injury, I think, are the right steps. And, you know, I think I was getting kind of frustrated watching games on Sunday and not getting the excitement of a return. Like, that was kind of starting to bother me. It's like, why is this play even here? So I do think that this is kind of a, you know, it's a change. I know change is hard for people to understand. I know, like, traditional football purists are like, you know, they're neutering the game or whatever's happening. And I understand that. But I also care about, you know, these guys being able to live long and healthy lives post their NFL careers. And I think this is a step in that direction. And I do think, you know, I did the radio play-by-play for the XFL with Grant Paulson when that was a thing. And for the Defenders, this was in 2020. And the thing that really stuck out to me is it did make the play more exciting. You did get more returns. You did get to see people making teams because of their return ability, right? It wasn't just a throwaway thing. Now, you know, in the NFL, you need a punt returner. Kick returner is a throwaway. This has changed that. I think this changes that dynamic for the better. I think this makes that back half of the roster more relevant because they actually have to cover kicks now. And I think all of those things are important, right? Player safety, encouraging that middle class of special teams player on the roster, encouraging, giving a guy an opportunity who is a return specialist to make the roster. So I do think there's value here. It's going to look different. It's going to be different. It's going to take some time to make sure that it works effectively. But if they do get that 80% return rate, like, I am all for it. I am 100% for this. And it's something that I think will help make the game on Sunday a little bit more exciting and make this play more relevant again.
For sure. And to be clear, they are now marking touchbacks on kickoffs at the 30. So that is going to encourage teams not to just kick the ball through the end zone, because giving the ball at the 30 to the other team is not exactly ideal compared to the 20 where it used to be. So I think that I agree with you. I would love to see them go full. I don't think this was the rule in the XFL in terms of onside kicks, no onside kicks. I'd love to see the 4th and 15, the 4th and 20, whatever you want to do. Super high risk, but you let the best players decide the game. Like, I would much rather see Patrick Mahomes on a 4th and 20 deciding a critical playoff game. Can he get that next possession versus an onside kick scramble situation that has nothing to do? Like, it's a play we see 14 times a year.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just like that to me is not as football-y as a, you know, quarterback lining up and playing offensive football.
Yeah.
So I think that is not making it into this revamp, but I do agree with you that one of the things the NFL has to figure out is, like, how do we keep the parts of the game that we like? Special teams is a huge deal beyond just kicking and like does the field goal go in or not, and getting this kickoff return back, I think is great. And there's a huge trickle down effect on the middle of the roster, like you said, that I think the NFLPA is probably pretty happy about as well. Not to mention the player safety concerns being alleviated.
Yeah. And again, like that, like why it's still hard. It's still challenging. You're still essentially doing the same technique, but like, I'm telling you, man, like that, like being a frontline kickoff guy was a brutal thing. Being a backline kickoff guy was a brutal thing. And so as much as like that was a nice way to kind of be like, hey, I'm, you know, making the NFL because I'm a true tough guy, I think these guys are also tough. I don't think it diminishes that in any way. I think it values space players a little bit more, but that's the way the game's going anyway. You know what I mean? Like they're, you know, you don't need those big bruising fullbacks back in the wedge anymore because that's not a thing. So get right. good space players, get good athletes. Like that's what you want for your DBs, your linebackers, your safeties. Let them fill that role. Let those guys, again, give them an opportunity to develop. You know, like that special teams player is like, it's like a farm system for the NFL. And so as that had started to erode from the NFL and the things that were going on in terms of kickoff coverage, that developmental element was also starting to leave. So I'm again, is it perfect? No, I do think that 4th and 15 thing would have been awesome, but is it perfect? No, but in terms of a direction that's going that makes the play relevant again, allow special teams coaches to do their job, I think this is a good step in that direction. And can they tweak it? Yes. And I understand it's different than what people are used to, but there's a lot of big changes that have made the game better, you know, and I think this is one of them.
For sure. And that was the last point I was going to bring up quickly is I'm excited for special teams coaches. Like you got a couple months here to get in the lab and figure out how you want to return kicks. Like how many players do you want in back at the 30? How many do you want at 35? How do you want if you're the kicking team, how do you want to attack whatever formation you're going to see? So like there's a lot of innovation that has to happen now. And certainly they'll watch some old XFL tape. But you got special teams coaches now that got to figure out some new stuff of how to return and cover kickoffs. That's going to be really fun. Of course, the big news that really blew up earlier in the week was the banning of the hip drop tackle, specifically as they're calling it the swivel hip drop tackle. So this is when a defensive player wraps up an offensive player around the hip, pulls them kind of around down to the ground and specifically lands on their legs. I have a very unpopular opinion, Logan, here, which is that I am really happy that they did this. I know this is really hard for defensive players, and I do think that there probably should be some discussions on how to make defensive players' lives easier because it seems like all they do is make it harder. But at the end of the day, the player safety risk outweighs the difficulty thing here. And when you watch a guy like Mark Andrews lose a ton of a season, Kenyon Drake, I saw the former Dolphins running back talking about how one of these tackles cost him a lot back in 2021, not to mention the physical pain that it can put them in. I know it's hard. I know it's unpopular, but like, this is a change that makes the game safer. It was trending in the wrong direction, and ultimately they go with the ban. That's where I sit on it. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I understand people's frustration because I want to watch football, you know, and I think they're going to have to work through how to call this. I think that's the thing I have an issue with is like, I want players to be safe. I don't want people to get hurt. It is a violent game. People do get hurt doing violent things. I understand that. And so that's where, I feel for the defensive players here. Like I've been hip tackled multiple times in my career. It does not feel great. Thank God I didn't hurt myself worse than, you know, just a mild ankle sprain or whatever. But I think it's just going to be hard to officiate. It's the thing that I have with it, right? Like I think the head up tackling was important. I think that change was essential. I think this kind of falls in the same vein. But it doesn't seem like it needs to be quite as immediate. It's a very specific thing they're trying to take out, right? It's like when you can still hip drop. I just can't drop on your legs, correct? That's
correct.
The way I read it. Yeah.
It's if like I use my entire body weight and launch myself and land on your legs, that is now illegal.
Yeah.
So if you can do it in a way where kind of like you fall to the ground and almost like is wrestling someone down, I grab you, I sit on the ground and then pull you over me. I think that is still fine and legal because at that point, like I'm on the ground, not on your legs.
Yeah.
It's when I like launch myself. And I think that's kind of a lot of the ways that if I'm a defensive coach, I would be thinking about teaching tackling these days is like, I need you to finish through the player. Because if you wrap up and go through the player, you're not at risk for basically anything except for if you spear a quarterback. But all those, you know, if you're in the field of play, you're not going to get in trouble for wrapping up. And that's the I think the big difference. If you launch, now you're probably going to get a penalty. But to your point, I think an important clarification that the league has put out here is they're not really going to push refs to call this. This is the kind of thing that's going to be legislated at the league level. If the refs see it and it's egregious, and you know, obviously if a guy gets hurt, you might be a little bit more obvious in calling it. But generally speaking, they're going to tell the refs, like, use your discretion. And use a lot of discretion. And if we review it and feel like a player broke the rules, we'll fine them, which is not going to feel good for the bank account, but you're not going to have a wishy-washy call affect a game on a Sunday in an ideal world of how this is going to be brought to the officials.
Yeah, no, I think that'll be the, I think that's probably the best way you could handle it. You know, again, with the kind of this gray rule. And I think, I don't know, Will, our producer, if you could look up, I think rugby banned this tackle a couple of years
ago.
That
is correct.
And it hasn't really affected the play there at all. And I think, to your point, Craig, it's because of how they coach the tackle, right? It's like they coach through the player. They still coach the alligator roll, which is something that you're probably pretty familiar with. You just can't land on the player's legs. So the alligator roll is like when the head's behind, like the ball carrier is running, you know, ahead of you. You put your hat behind instead of in front of the ball. You rip around, and I can still rip around. I just can't fall on your legs. And so I think all of those kind of traditional tackles that people are thinking of that are going to be banned, I don't think will be banned by this rule. It's just a very specific, I'm on your hips. It's usually when a player is getting dragged, instead of sitting on the ground, they intentionally do it. They jump on the back of your legs so you fall. And I think like that's by the rule, by the thing you just described, is it should be very relatively clear and a very small percentage of total tackles, I would think. But again, like I always get nervous when they legislate tackling because it is harder on the defender. But I don't, at least in my recollection, I don't think it comes up as often as people think.
It's so bang bang that I do feel like it's something that the way they're going to officiate this at the league level, so to speak, is probably the correct way. I feel bad for defensive players; they're going to get fined, but at least you're subject to a review, and it's not like you do it. You get flagged, you cost your team the game, and then the league is like, sorry, we messed up. Like, if you get fined, it's because you did the thing. The Australian Rugby League did ban this tackle in 2023, and they still tackle just fine. So I think that's an important caveat. And to the numbers side of it, Logan, like you said, it's somewhat rare. These tackles happened 235 times in the NFL last season, which turns out to be about once per game.
Every game? Wow.
That's about one per each individual game. So every single game that gets played, you probably have one of these tackles on average, and 15 times. So about once a week, you saw a player sustain a multi-week injury. So they leave the game and they miss at least one other game. So like it's happening frequently enough that you have a major injury problem. And if you can get it out of the game, that's good. And by the way, those numbers were trending up. I mentioned that in passing earlier, but those numbers were getting worse year over year. So if you can get it out of the game and ultimately, you know, make the game safer, but not have these huge officiating blowups that change the scope of games in games, doesn't change the flow. I think that's the best way to go about it. And that's what they're trying to do.
And that's a pretty low frequency. You know, honestly, like one a game, you know, one in 70 plays, I don't think this will be this drastic effect. You know, I know people are upset about it and I understand why. And again, I'm a traditionalist. I don't like when they legislate tackling like this, but I understand the motivation by the league to kind of keep players safe. So
I also think that there are things that they could do to make the game easier for defensive players.
Yeah.
And like some of the stuff that they have legislated out for competitive reasons to try to increase scoring, we can go back on that.
Yeah,
and like some of it is every rule change is the NFL is making it harder for defensive players. So if we go, hey, this is non-negotiable because it's a player safety issue, what's the thing that we can go back on and give defensive players in return? And some of it's just like changing points of emphasis. Like if I'm going to bat down a pass and I accidentally brush the quarterback's helmet, we don't need a 15-yard personal foul penalty. Like that's insane.
Yeah.
So I think there's things that the league can and should do to kind of give back to defensive players. But for a player safety reason, as the 230 tackles that it was last year was a 65% increase year over year, clearly stemming this before it gets out of hand and really, you know, does more damage than it's already done, I think was the right move. Okay, that is our show for today. And one more pod this week as we continue to march towards the NFL draft. So we'll talk to you later in the week. Thanks for listening. See you on the radio. Until then, for Logan, I'm Craig here on Take.